Welcome to the Catch 22 Minutes podcast, where we discuss some of the UK's major social challenges. We speak to frontline experts, industry leaders, and people with lived experience, all in pursuit of ideas for reforming public services. My name is Jessie Cochran, comms manager at Catch 22, and in this season, alongside our guests, we'll be focused on solutions. Solutions which could impact every aspect of the justice sector, from how we support victims to the way individuals are supported in our prisons and in the community. So hidden victims are people who do not access victim services, even though these services are free and independent of the police. Some do not trust the services, some are trapped in a cycle of crime and so are nervous of engaging. Some do not understand that they have been a victim of crime. Many hidden victims are from vulnerable groups, including homeless victims, those of domestic and sexual violence, those with language barriers, or very young or elderly victims, among others. Hidden victims may not understand the offence which has occurred. We may not know their location or the number of individuals affected. They are particularly vulnerable, lack support, and may be wary of reporting a crime to police. Hidden victims are also not included in official crime statistics, and underreporting means that funding does not get allocated to these groups of particularly vulnerable people. To discuss this and more, today I'm joined by Emma Jones, Director of Victim Services at Catch 22, and Millie Gant, Juniper Lodge Manager, a sexual assault referral centre based in Leicestershire. Hi, Millie.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Emma.
Hi, Josie.
To start off with, Emma, could you tell me what concerns you about hidden victims more so than, say, any other person who might need the support of a victim service?
What concerns me the most about our hidden victims is that they're either not aware that they are a victim in the first place and therefore are not aware of or to services. So if victims don't know that support is available or that they're even entitled to support, their needs will go unmet. And the emotional impact of this without help can be devastating and long lasting for some. So this can then have an impact on other services such as mental health. So if needs are going unmet, you're particularly affecting people's mental health. It could be that people are losing their jobs if they're being impacted at work. It can also impact on people's relationships if they're not coping well with what's happened. The other concern for me is those that are caught up in a victim-perpetrator cycle and might never get out of it with the right support. So a couple of years ago, I did meet with a Crown Court judge during a break on a trial. So I was chatting to him about what case he was currently working on. He told me about a young boy that had been caught carrying a knife and was therefore at court as an offender. And actually, once they got deeper into the trial and found out the reason for him carrying a knife, it's because he had been threatened with a knife. And actually, for me, I thought, well, if he had received support in the first place as a victim for being threatened with a knife, would he then be standing on trial as an offender?
Millie, any thoughts on that?
I suppose just to echo what Emma said about people not realising that they are a victim, what we see in our service is that people will come forward a long, long time after something's happened. It may have happened when they were children, and it's only since they're adults and they actually want to then deal with what presents to them, because it might be that they're suffering from some other physical conditions and or mental health issues, like Emma mentioned, and they can track it back to what happened when they're a child. So at the time, they didn't understand that they were a victim. But then when they're an adult, they realise that all of the issues that they've got, maybe it's mental health, substance misuse and relationship issues, is all to do with what's happened as a child.
So I imagine this is something that probably affects both of you, but services nationwide are consistently having to balance supporting those approaching their support services and those already engaging with doing more community outreach. Who do you think we're really struggling to reach, and why might this be? Emma, shall I start with you, just because you deal with a broader spectrum of victims, and then we'll go a bit more specific into those Millie's working with?
Sure. So we are currently finding that all of our services are under pressure. And as you say, I'm sure Millie's finding the same. So finding the balance for us between outreach and existing casework is becoming ever more demanding. We have actually found that the pandemic has not only created more vulnerable individuals, but has also exacerbated the needs of those who are already vulnerable. So for us, we are sort of trying our best to be creative and innovative with the ways that we can reach and engage with victims. So using virtual and digital means. So, for example, our app that we've just launched in Hertfordshire, and also our virtual community cafes in our Leicestershire service. So in terms of being creative with engaging with victims, we try to attend as many community events as possible. We use our social media, delivering workshops and sessions to external partners and in schools. So I think that's really important what Millie was just saying there about perhaps children not understanding that they are a victim. So we have actually found that by going out into schools, we do have a sexual harm children young person worker going out into schools delivering workshops on consent and healthy relationships. And that has actually led to disclosure, meaning that we are being able to reach more victims and be able to put that support in place.
Just on a practical level there, Emma, how does it work with the disclosure and a referral from that outreach? Do they sort of approach the person delivering the workshop afterwards, or?
Yeah, it could be both. So it could either be a teacher has picked up on something within the class, or that child has made a disclosure to a teacher at a later stage, or when we've been doing sort of workshops and sessions to partners, again, they've then been able to spot those signs and be able to have more open and honest conversations with children about perhaps something that might be going on for them.
Millie, how are you managing that kind of tension?
I think we're in a slightly different position to Emma because we're a sexual assault referral centre and they're directly commissioned by NHS England and they're nationwide. Our sort of services are quite acute. They happen in the initial stages. So because we're a referral centre, we would refer on to specialist support such as independent sexual violence advisors, ISFAs. And we've also got the child versions, which are called CHISFAs. So I know that Freeva, that provide those, are doing some exceptional work around targeting those communities that don't sort of represent within the SARC, but also those communities that might need a little bit of more support. So good examples is that they've just recruited a learning disability ISFA that's specialist. They've also got a BAME specialist and LGBTQ plus specialist. So they work with those specialist services in order just to understand and support those vulnerable victims a little bit more. What we do, because we've got a clinical side to us as well, we've gone in with our crisis workers and our forensic nurses into emergency departments. So we've got a regular slot every month. We've created some little cards around forensic timescales. So when somebody presents within A&E, they're able to use our robust pathway. So it might be that they treat the injuries first and that they contact us. And that's either with or without the police involvement. So it really empowers those victims to sort of say, actually, I don't want to report to the police right now, but I do want some level of support. I want my evidence gathering so that at a later date, if I feel that I want to, I can take that forward. We've also done inputs into GPs, which has been really interesting because of the services that we offer here, they do dovetail in quite nicely. So we've covered that. Universities as well. We're lucky that we've got three really good universities in Leicester, Leicestershire and Rutland. So we've worked with those universities' teams, again, just to highlight what we're doing to make sure they understand our referral pathways. We've been doing inputs to new offices, to new recruits, and also within our three male prisons in Leicestershire. So we've got a bit of a prison pilot going on at the minute that's lasted 2 years. That's where we proactively go in and we provide counselling for those people that might have suffered either as children or as adults. So we are really trying to target those vulnerable groups. And just for sexual violence, we know that those groups are males, LGBTQ and people from racialised communities.
I talked about it a bit in the introduction, but what do you think are the main reasons those groups are particularly hard to reach?
I know you mentioned earlier about the trust in the police and the trust in the services. We do offer exactly the same services with or without police involvement, and we call that self-referral, and all of our sort of community champions do push that and make sure that people are aware of it. But I wanted to delve a little bit deeper, and for the last 18 months, we created a SARC survey that anybody could feed into, and we captured the reasons why people didn't report to the police and why they didn't want to come forward. And then the other side of it was that if somebody had reported, if they chose to disengage, what were those reasons why? And it was really quite interesting because anecdotally, some people will say within our services, oh, it's to do with the police or it's the court, they're really scared of going to court. But what we found is that it was about people's mental health. People didn't feel that they were strong enough to go through the process. And when you see all this negative media and the stories that they cover, that was a big reason that people just couldn't put their life on hold for a year, 2 years to go through that process. There were some elements of worried about that process because it was long, but fundamentally it was to do with people not being strong enough. And then when they had reported, it just felt that the pressure was too much and that they just wanted to stop. They just couldn't cope with it. So I found that really, really interesting. And as a result, we've extended our mental health nurse provision at the SARC. We've got a dedicated mental health nurse. It's come from the local trust, and she provides us some specialist hours where she can assess anyone that we've got concerns about and escalate any appointments and just update the client's records so that, like, community psychiatric nurses are updated and people know that they've accessed our service. So we've sort of made sure that that's embedded within our service because we know mental health is such a problem.
And just with that research you just mentioned, with it actually not being an issue with maybe faith in the justice system, do you think that still classes sexual violence victims as hidden victims?
I think it applies to everybody. There is barriers with everybody, whether you're an older person, a younger person, you come from a racialized community. Everybody's still got those sort of shame, embarrassment, the pressure. They don't want people to know about what's happened. It's a really private and real sensitive issue, isn't it? So I think it applies to everybody, but some of those sort of communities that are more vulnerable, it's really magnified for them. So if you're a male and you identify as a gay male, you've got double barriers, haven't you? So that's where the services within the community that we work with are so important, because these people will present in these little pockets of sort of essential services like emergency departments, like GPs, especially sexual health clinics. And that's where we've worked really closely with those partners to make sure we've got a real easy, clear, robust pathway to get them into our service. Even if they just want to come and have a chat about what support is available, or if they want to explore recovering some evidence, we just would rather them be here rather than thinking, I can't speak to the police. So that's why we really push our self-referral.
Fab, thanks, Millie. Emma, any thoughts on all of that? I know all of your victim services work closely with sexual assault victims, but I imagine there's some trends with other crime types.
Yeah, absolutely. And similarly, as Millie mentioned, we also will accept self-referrals. So although all of our Catch-22 victim services are commissioned by police and crime commissioners, we are completely independent from the police. And it's really important for us to maintain our independence so that victims know that they can gain access to support regardless of criminal justice involvement. And Millie mentioned the sort of the shame, embarrassment factor, particularly around sexual violence. But we also find that with fraud victims. So quite often when we are working with victims of fraud, we're the first person that they've spoken to about what's happened outside. You know, they won't speak to friends and family about it because, you know, if there's been a loss of finance, for example, we've had victims who have perhaps lost their entire life savings and actually don't feel that they can speak to their family about that. So it definitely exists with other crime types. And again, we've talked about children and young people quite a lot. And I mentioned the example with the young boy with the knife earlier. And again, I think we find that actually there is that embarrassment to come forward as a young person and say, I need help, I need support.
Thanks, Emma. We actually had an episode on fraud victims and that came up a few times. It's just that, particularly when you talk about kind of romance fraud and the shame that comes with that over how could I let myself get in this situation. Just my last question here. I say question, there's a few questions here that kind of come into one, but it's come up a few times in this series that the term victim evokes this lack of empowerment. When we did the episode on restorative justice, that came up a lot. There's this real loss of empowerment in victims, often from the very sector that's meant to be helping them rebuild resilience. What do you think of this? How can we change public perception of victims? And why do you think we should? Millie, can I start with you?
Using victim or any other terminology, we find it's really, really challenging. The key is communicating this with the person that you're supporting who is accessing your services. Coming from a police background, you know, that those sort of words, complainant or victim, used to describe the survivor or person that's affected by sexual violence, that's done because those terms are commonly used in law. So that's where it becomes a little bit tricky. But when you look at other people that have been affected by sexual violence, we find it's not just the person that has been attacked or abused, it's perhaps their family members, their partners. So that term victim is really, really wide reaching. And it is something that we're actually going to be working on next week with our partners, because we're working together on creating a sort of lived experience panel that will service LLR, Leicester, Leicestershire and Rutland. And that's like the first thing that we're going to kick off with, because I've noticed within different organisations, we all use different terms. If you're clinical, it's more like patient. Client is a real counselling type word or term, but that word victim, it is disempowering. It defines somebody, and I think Emma said earlier, sometimes people don't think they're victims, and it's a real trigger when you say victim. There's no problem with using people's names within services and when we deal with them, but when we're doing written reports or there's something that we need to share, it's just being really careful and being respectful and just to ask for their preference. You do hear victims and survivors quite a lot within our arena. My sort of thoughts are that victim tends to be used in the acute phases, the initial phases, and sort of survivor when you've, you know, gone through that journey and you're beginning to heal and beginning to move your life forward. But yeah, a range of terms and words are used by different organisations, which just compounds those issues. Yeah, and you know, just thinking about some of the processes that these people can go through, if a police have investigated and they've said that we can't do anything more, you know, they've got an option, which is supported by their independent sexual violence advisor, for a victim's right to review. I mean, that's what it's called, a victim's right to review. And if it goes to court, the case goes to court, they've got another option called a victim's personal statement. Again, those two words can be quite triggering, but to be changing those to something else might present some confusing issues with those people that are investigating and prosecuting. So I can definitely see both sides. Emma, is there anything you wanted to say? Because you're quite broad with...
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything that you've just said, Millie. I'm furiously nodding along as you're talking there. The word victim isn't going anywhere. We, you know, we're not going to be able to get rid of that word because, as you say, it's a description, especially with the Victims Bill later to be enshrined in law this year. It's called the Victims Law. So, and you know, with the definition of victim within that. So we will be continuing to use that word. But as you say, it can be disempowering. We support people who have been affected by crime who might not necessarily be the direct victim, as you say. And I think, you know, personally for us, we will always be led by the individual that we're supporting on the term that they feel comfortable with. We sort of interchangeably use the term victim with service user, client, kind of terms that you've already said. And again, talking about those who don't realise that they're victims, I think it can be a really difficult one to address. So we talked about victims of romance scams. So they believe that the perpetrator is in love with them. They don't necessarily believe that they have been a victim. And it can take us quite a long time and a lot of patience and rapport building to be able to get them to that point where they realise that actually this is a scam. I think as well, when we're talking about learning disability hate crime, so they might not necessarily been aware that they've been a victim of hate crime. They just see it as a part of everyday life. So again, for us, it's just about building a relationship, having that rapport with the victim and talking to them about the facts and what's happened and, you know, getting them to a safe place where they understand what it is that's happened, regardless of what term that they then want to use to call themselves.
I wonder if even bringing in a victim's bill is something to say that actually these victims are entitled to what they're going through. They're entitled to stand up for themselves. And 'cause even the word defendant sounds more empowering.
I think there is stigma attached to the word victim. Yeah. But I think with the victim's law coming out, perhaps we can, you know, we can as services change that meaning and make it a lot more empowering. As we say now, that it's going to be sort of enshrined in what you're entitled to and what your rights are as a victim.
Yeah, I was just going to mention again about the word defendant. That's, again, another sort of terminology that different organisations will use different words, suspect, defendant, you know, all of those. And like I said before, it's just about agreeing with that person that if any communication's got to happen between agencies, that you use people's names. But again, that's where some of these specialist organisations can sort of help and support, and giving that person a bit of time just to understand why they may be referred to as a victim, and just sort of making sure that they understand why, and it isn't to re-traumatise, and it's not to define somebody. It's just that a lot of things happen during that victim's journey that we'll use that word victim. And if we were to have a magic wand and, you know, you'd say to me, what would you like to change that to? I don't think I'd personally change it, because there's so much stuff that actually says victim, and everybody knows what that is for. So, you know, the victim's bill, the victim's code of practice that the police use, if we use something else, it's going to be really confusing. But it's just that agreement between those agencies that these are the terms that we can use, but this is what this person prefers. And it might be something when we're referring between services, just as an additional check, you know, we ask what people's names are and we ask what they would prefer to be called. We might even ask their pronouns. So it might be something that in the future, once that victim's bill is in and we're picking up little elements of it, especially around sexual abuse, where again things become magnified and it might present a barrier to somebody accessing, just thinking about how we could make that easier for somebody.
Thanks, Millie and Emma, for joining us for this episode of Catch 22 Minutes. We talked about how we address the negative connotations around the word victim, what it means to be a hidden victim, and why it is so important to focus on the needs of local communities. Hidden victims are everywhere, and they're often missed because they may not know their rights, they may not have confidence in the system, or they may be dealing with other personal issues before they would consider seeking justice. Ensuring everyone knows their rights and the support available to them helps people to move forward, reduces re-victimisation, and takes the pressure off other systems. Thank you for listening to Catch 22 Minutes of Justice. Let us know your thoughts on this episode or any others using hashtag Catch 22 Minutes.